blood and kept selling them. That does it for our show. And a very special congratulations to our senior video producer, Sam Alkoff, on his wedding yesterday to his longtime partner, Anna Gold. Oh, and congrats to their children, Arthur and Nina. That does it for our program. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, with Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Shrufa Bokadus, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prue, Dennis McCormick, Maddie Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
KBOO Portland. KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding virtual information sessions from now through June. KBOO's Board of Directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of all of our members. BIPOC persons are especially encouraged to apply. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/boardrecruiting. Thank you for considering board work at KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
For the first time, a jury has found a former president of the United States guilty of felonies. As fallout over January's midair blowout over PDX continues, Boeing says it has a new safety plan, what the FAA's leader says after reviewing it. And from the cleanup of toxic algae to better solutions for the houseless, Multnomah County residents tell leaders what they think the county should spend its money on. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 30th, 2024. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. First, breaking news. Former President Trump has been found guilty on all 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. Judge Juan Merchan has announced a sentencing date of July 11th. The jury reached that guilty verdict in the former president's hush money criminal trial. After the announcement of the verdict, Trump came out of Manhattan criminal court, and this is what he said.
This was a disgrace. This was a rigged trial by a conflicted judge who was corrupt. It's a rigged trial, a disgrace. They wouldn't give us a venue change. We were at 5% or 6% in this district, in this area. This was a rigged, disgraceful trial. But the real verdict is going to be November 5th by the people. And they know what happened here, and everybody knows what happened here. You have a Soros-backed DA and the whole thing. We didn't do a thing wrong. I'm a very innocent man, and it's okay. I'm fighting for our country. I'm fighting for our Constitution. Our whole country is being rigged right now. This was done by the Biden administration in order to wound or hurt an opponent, a political opponent. And I think it's just a disgrace. And we'll keep fighting, we'll fight till the end, and we'll win. Because our country's gone to hell. We don't have the same country anymore. We have a divided mess. We're a nation in decline, serious decline. Millions and millions of people pouring into our country right now from prisons and from mental institutions, terrorists. And they're taking over our country. We have a country that's in big trouble. But this was a rigged decision right from day one. With a conflicted judge who should have never been allowed to try this case, never. And we will fight for our Constitution. This is long from over. Thank you very much.
And that was a defiant former President Donald Trump reacting after a New York jury of his peers found him guilty on all 34 felony charges of falsifying business records related to hush money payments to a porn star prior to the 2016 presidential election. Donald Trump is the first U.S. president with a criminal conviction and will be the first major party candidate to run for the White House as a convicted felon. His sentencing could carry a maximum prison sentence of 4 years. It is likely that Trump will appeal this guilty verdict. Now, even before the jury made this announcement of a guilty verdict, Trump called it a very sad day for America and a rigged, disgraceful trial. Here's today's edition of 2024 Talks.
Mother Teresa could not beat these charges. These charges are rigged. The whole thing is rigged. The whole country's a mess between the borders and fake elections.
A visibly distraught former President Donald Trump comparing himself to Mother Teresa as his porn star hush money case reaches the jury. Before leaving after the first day's deliberation, jurors asked for copies of two key witnesses' testimony as well as the judge's instructions. Trump and allied members of Congress are pointing to a Texas anti-immigration group's report that claims as many as a quarter of non-citizens are registered to vote. Experts say that's plainly untrue and call it misinformation corrosive to democracy. David Becker with the Center for Election Innovation and Research says the actual number is well under 1%.
We should have as much confidence in our elections now as we have ever had in American history. But because of lies being spread by election losers, we see our election system is experiencing doubt.
An examination last month of Ohio's voter rolls by the Republican Secretary of State found fewer than 150 non-citizens registered out of 8 million voters. But other surveys show increasing numbers of Americans distrust elections when their party loses. The Colorado Supreme Court has suspended the law license of former Trump attorney Jenna Ellis for 3 years. Ellis pleaded guilty to one felony count after trying to overturn the Georgia 2020 presidential results.
I believe in and I value election integrity. If I knew then what I know now, I would have declined to represent Donald Trump in these post-election challenges.
First Lady Jill Biden appeared on The View. She said rules in place for next month's presidential debate between Trump and President Joe Biden should work like effective guardrails.
American people deserve a debate because you need to see your choices. You need to see Trump and you need to see the president and you need to see the differences.
Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito says he won't recuse himself from January 6 insurrection cases, even though two flags connected to the riot were flown outside his homes. Tennessee Democrat Steve Cohen is leading a censure effort in the House.
Well, what he's done is contrary to his oath of office, it's contrary to what the role of a Supreme Court justice should be, which is to be impartial at all times and avoid even the appearance of impropriety.
New reporting from the New York Times cast doubt on Alito's story about a U.S. flag flown upside down at his home. Advocates for Iowa's seniors say they will likely vote for lower drug costs and protections for Social Security and Medicare. Brad Anderson is with AARP Iowa.
One thing we know for sure is that older voters will dominate the overall turnout. During the last primary election in 2022, 77% were 50 or older.
Anderson says despite steps in the Inflation Reduction Act to cut some drug costs, it remains a hurdle for many. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Since the January 5th midair blowout of a door on a jet over Portland's airport, Boeing has been promising a new plan addressing safety. Today, the company released that plan, and Federal Aviation Administrator Mike Whitaker met with Boeing leaders and announced his agency will continue to hold the plane maker accountable.
We've made quite a few changes since that January 5th incident, most significantly putting a couple dozen inspectors in the facility itself. So moving from more of an audit approach to oversight to audit plus inspection, that continues and that will continue going forward. We have a lot more folks involved in the oversight generally and a lot more inspection points. And on Boeing's side, they have reduced production rate to allow more of the workforce to focus on the airplanes they're building. So we've always had significant staffing for oversight, but it was more focused on an audit approach to oversight rather than having actual inspectors in the building. So we've changed that model from audit to audit plus, if you will, where we have inspectors as well as audit. And also talking to folks on the floor and getting a more accurate picture of what's happening. Certainly having inspectors on the floor gives us much better insight to what's actually happening on the floor. And the event of January 5th has highlighted some deficits in the quality and safety management systems at Boeing. And so we've got a pretty big focus on it ensuring that those change before we increase production. We are going to continue to have the constant engagement that we've had. So a weekly meeting is the minimum. We're going to have people on the floor virtually every day. I will continue to have quarterly meetings directly with the CEO. So the next one will be in September in Seattle. And we're going to continue that engagement. It won't change now that the plan is in place. It will continue to be an intensive engagement. I can characterize today's meeting as being very much roll up the sleeves and go into a very deep dive into the plan, various elements of the plan, how things are being measured, how they're being executed. So it was very much a working meeting that ran beyond its allotted time. They have provided us with their growth plan, and we're working with them on that growth plan going forward. And as we go through the next few months, we'll start to define what we expect. The quality assurance measures that are being proposed include suppliers, and they have worked extensively, not just with Spirit Aerospace, but other suppliers as part of that process. My confidence level is not necessarily relevant, but we will monitor that closely as we go forward to make sure they're fully in compliance. I can say that they have given us some very specific examples of how they have encouraged more people to use their voluntary reporting system, and that they're seeing a greater usage of that system, so that's progress. They have been very focused on ensuring that production is done in the proper sequence so that significant components such as the fuselage aren't shipped until they are built exactly within specification. So what they refer to as traveled work. So reducing that travel work has reduced the risk of error. So there have been concrete steps, but I'll leave it to Boeing to go into more detail on those. We have a number of inspectors on the ground. We have a lot of people who are 60% devoted to Boeing, but also have other duties. So we don't have a precise number, but I will say it's a significant increase from where we were, and that increase will remain steady state going forward. I think once we get down the road, we see how they're doing on implementation, we'll make that call as it comes. So this was really a Boeing's meeting to present the comprehensive plan in detail. It focused around an extensive PowerPoint presentation that broke the plan down into segments. So a lot of time spent on SMS, a lot of time spent on quality assurance, a lot of time spent on employee engagement, on training, on hiring, all the elements of the plan in some detail, how they'll be measured. So it really was a deep dive into what we had asked for, a comprehensive plan. No surprises.
And that was FAA Administrator Mike Whitaker. What should Multnomah County spend its hundreds of millions of dollars on? More than 70 people signed up to speak, and 150 others offered written testimony last night for a final public hearing as the commissioners decide on their budget priorities before June 6th. Here's what some of the citizens had to say.
I'm here to advocate for the Willamette River and the problem with the stagnant water in the Ross Island Lagoon. Unfortunately, with the algae bloom that's been happening the last few summers, it's becoming a problem. If I stay in my kayak, I'm safe, but I like to jump out of the kayak and jump in the river. And that doesn't always work anymore with the algae bloom, basically poison water. And the river is such a great resource for us here in Portland. I hate to see it not being safe for swimming, not being safe to use, not being safe for dogs.
I write to encourage you to spend three times whatever you budgeted on legal services for eviction defense. Eviction is a leading cause of houselessness. Multnomah County has a houselessness problem. It's easy to see. What's harder to see from roadways driving by is that evictions hit vulnerable populations harder. Women of color, especially Black mothers in particular. Here, eviction rates are well above pre-pandemic levels. Nationally, we know providing tenants legal advice during eviction proceedings saves money. Fewer public service dollars are needed to support people who are housed. Unsurprisingly, when tenants have legal advice, they stay housed.
I'm talking today to ask you to provide a bare minimum adequate cost of living adjustment for all of us frontline workers. There is, especially in the era post-pandemic, where housedness is continuing to spiral out of control, and we are trying to do our utmost as a group of people who are disproportionately queer, brown, and women, and also disproportionately underpaid. For the same reasons that many people become unhoused, that housing is too expensive, that affording food and medical care is too expensive, we are also oftentimes on the verge of becoming unhoused ourselves. And in this, the last opportunity for us to ask you to consider giving us more than the 3.3% cost of living adjustment that has been proposed, I and other members of my union are speaking today to ask you to consider at least a 5%. That would allow us to continue doing the essential work that we do that supports so many others to become productive and safe and happy members of our community.
I want to speak about being homeless or houseless and what I see every day when I ride the streetcar. I think it's a shame in our country that there isn't more help for people. I've been homeless more than once or twice in Portland, off and on, since the mid-70s. And I know how difficult it is to get up and off the streets. The difference for me is I haven't been unwilling to speak up. I haven't been unwilling to beat on doors and find a way to get it done. But when you're on the street, there's no place to write a resume. There's no place to make an application. And I'm just asking, please, that Multnomah County commissioners fund anything that has to do with housing, anything that will help people get off the street. Once you're there, it's a nightmare.
Many times people leave treatment looking for that next step. And due to lack of availability of sober living, some go back to the streets or other places that aren't supportive of recovery. I also previously managed a sober living house for women and children where I got to witness the life-changing outcomes of supportive housing, such as reunification between mothers and their children. Recovery housing could also be a beneficial part of any deflection efforts made in Multnomah County, as it provides many benefits to the recovery process. I'm asking that the county make investments into recovery housing, as it is a crucial part of the continuum of care and the overall well-being of the community we serve.
I was one of over 1,400 veterans in Oregon who spent the night outside on any given night. Rewinding to my last day out there, I was breaking down in a hotel room. The drugs weren't working. Things were getting worse. Over the next 2 days, I would see myself get turned away from a treatment center. But my sister made the decision to give me a place to stay for the night and organize my entrance into treatment. I'm grateful that support found me during my 72 hours of willingness. This propelled me to complete treatment, get referred to supportive housing, and build the life that I have today. Since then, I've graduated college, become a present husband, father, and son, and in 2 days, I'll celebrate 6 years of sustained abstinence and recovery. We need to do better for our veterans, but we also need to do better for our children. Today, I had the opportunity to meet with a program participant who's been engaged with the foster system throughout their life. This was somebody that was not engaged in school. They were caught in hard drug use, and they didn't have the self-efficacy to believe that they could build something different for themselves. Since then, I've seen them celebrate 90 days of sustained abstinence, get enrolled in school, find a sponsor, and develop an identity and pathway that works for them. And this is where I'm concerned. I talked about the role that my family played in my ability to initiate and sustain my own recovery, but not everybody has those same assets. As Oregonians and as adults, we have a responsibility to ensure that housing exists so that our kids can transition into those supports and sustain the life that they have built within their recovery.
And those are the voices of some of the people speaking out at last night's public hearing on the Multnomah County budget. Meantime, in the U.S. Capitol, the Senate Finance Committee heard from a Portlander as senators try to come up with solutions for the nation's fentanyl crisis.
My name is Tony Vesna. I'm the executive director of 4D Recovery. I'm also the chair of Oregon's Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission, though my remarks today do not represent these organizations. It has been 11 years, 11 months, and 26 days since the last time I used heroin or any other substance. On July 19th, 2012, I was arrested at a convenience store in Portland, Oregon for possession of heroin, and I haven't used since. I had wanted to quit for some time and had attempted treatment several times before that. My motivation to get sober was simple. It was for my daughter. I had made a promise to myself at a young age that if I ever had a kid, they wouldn't know the isolation and despair I felt as a result of my parents' addiction. I was born in Idaho, but my mom fled when I was young to Camas, Washington to get away from drugs and crime my father was involved with. I partied in high school like other kids, but unlike some of my peers, I had a predisposition to addiction. A combination of genetic circumstances and my own personal choices resulted in a 9-year opioid career, which took off in high school when my mother was prescribed an absurd amount of Oxycontin. Everyone is aware of how Oxycontin impacted our nation, and now we're facing a drug that is much more powerful, addictive, and lacks government oversight. Fentanyl, or what the kids that I work with call fetty. According to the CDC, over 20 teenagers die every week from drug overdoses, and fentanyl is the leading cause of death for this age group. I can hope my testimony moves this committee to advance our nation's response to our addiction crisis, because I know that people can and do recover when they're given the tools to do so. This committee can address the crisis in many ways, but I'll highlight a few that draw from my personal and professional experience. Foremost, we need to protect our children by preventing them from becoming addicted in the first place with primary prevention, and then swiftly intervene with school-based interventions and connections to critical treatment recovery services for those who have substance issues. I believe we could utilize CHIP funds to bolster prevention and school-based interventions. We can increase Medicaid rates and provide startup funds for new treatment programs. According to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration, 97% of adolescents with a substance use disorder in 2022 did not receive care. And according to the National Institutes of Health, the average wait time for an adolescent residential treatment bed is 28 days. This is unacceptable. We must capitalize on the opportunity to provide treatment immediately when people seek it. When I was addicted, if I had to wait for treatment, there was a good chance I would not make my appointment. And with the fentanyl risk of fatality, it is more important than ever to create access on demand. We can increase access to peer-delivered services by allowing Medicaid billing in recovery centers and also pre-treatment engagements. Recovery centers provide sober social hubs for people in recovery to build relationships and access recovery support groups. I still attend recovery meetings today and they still keep me sober. Pre-treatment peer outreach services allow people in recovery like me to go out and encourage people using to seek help. We can fund recovery residences, also known as sober livings. After leaving residential treatment, I moved into a sober house and lived there for a few years. Being around other sober people reinforced my commitment to recovery and provided time for me to go to college, pay off debt, and purchase my first home. Lastly, we can increase access to medication-assisted treatments. This is probably the quickest way to address the issue. Some people balk at this proposition because they think it's replacing one drug with another, and I used to think that, but I realized that it's more like other replacement therapies. Take smoking cigarettes, for example. If a person was to quit smoking and switch to patches, nobody would say anything. I have a large scar on my left forearm from an abscess I got from injecting Vicodin. Apparently, you can't do that. While I was in the hospital, I was detoxing from heroin. I begged the medical staff to prescribe me medication, which they did not. They did, however, later on have a priest stop by, which I did appreciate, but I didn't think you could exercise the addiction out of me. And so I left the hospital daily to get well on heroin. If that were me today, the likelihood I would have overdosed would be exponential. We must provide people with medication-assisted treatment, especially those exiting jail. A vast majority of people in jail have an associated addiction with their crimes. I'm not advocating for abolishing jail. You know, it saved my life. But I do think we should rehabilitate people so that when they exit, they can reenter society as contributing members. This week, a classroom full of American teenagers will die from drug overdoses. You know, I have three kids. They're very important to me. The likelihood that they'll have addiction is pretty high, given my family. And I just really hope that and implore you all to take swift action that expands access to care and ultimately saves lives, because our kids depend on it.
And that was Portlander Tony Vesna speaking to the U.S. Senate Finance Committee about the nation's fentanyl crisis. The senators also heard from Dr. Caleb Banta Green, who's from Washington State.
It is heartening to see the leadership of the Pacific Northwest, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington really demonstrating their leadership by holding this hearing. As a health services and public health researcher, it is an honor to participate. My name is Caleb Banta Green, and I have worked to support individuals and communities impacted by opioid use disorder for nearly 30 years. Over this time, the predominant opiate has changed multiple times, and models of care and treatment medications have evolved. We have made a dent in the treatment gap, that is, the gap between those with active opioid use disorder and those on the medications methadone and buprenorphine. These medications are the most evidence-based treatments for opioid use disorder. They support ongoing recovery and they reduce mortality by at least 50%. Unfortunately, the treatment gap persists, with approximately 3/4 of those with opioid use disorder not on life-saving medications. Opioid treatment programs, primarily using methadone, and medical office-based treatment using buprenorphine are excellent models of care. Yet despite our decades of effort to expand these models of care, they continue to serve the minority of people with opioid use disorder. Policymakers and healthcare systems continue to improve these two models of care and expand access, but it is clear we need a new third model of care as well. Non-pharmaceutical fentanyl has exacerbated this need for a new model of care. Fentanyl is a very potent and inexpensive drug that presents substantial risk for rapid development of opioid use disorder and high risk for overdose. Fundamentally, we need to make it easier to access treatment medications than it is to access fentanyl. As part of our ongoing research, we regularly interview people who use drugs and are accessing overdose and infectious disease prevention services. Our published research shows that 80% of people who are misusing opioids do want to stop or reduce their use. 70% do want to be on these life-saving treatment medications, and yet most are not able to access care in the traditional healthcare and treatment systems. Further, 3/4 of these folks want to obtain healthcare at these community-based programs at a place where they know and with people with whom they trust. Over the last 10 years, we and others have been developing and testing new models of care based on clients' stated needs, health services and public health data, and research-supported interventions. We are combining a low-barrier clinical model with community-based access points and a team-based model of care. To support the treatment medication prescriber, we have added nurse care managers, mental health care managers, and care navigators. These folks provide the majority of face time with clients, and they provide vital supports so that people can start and stay engaged in care. People in recovery from opioid use disorder have served in these medical and care navigator roles, and their insights and ability to quickly build trust with clients have been invaluable. This new care model has positively influenced the care continuum that you're seeing up here. We are finding that jails and emergency departments that were once hesitant to start people on medications because they didn't think they would show up in a medical appointment in the next week or two, they're now starting people on buprenorphine because they know there is a place in the community providing drop-in access to medications and other supports. These community-based health hubs for people who use drugs are showing positive outcomes, including in our research with 6 rural and urban communities across Washington state, where we found significant increases in buprenorphine use and significant declines in deaths. To date, these programs have been funded with one-time funds, including grant dollars. What we need is a bundled care model, an alternative payment model, with adequate funding to pay for the complete care team in these community-based settings. Again, we need the flexibility in locating community care and adequate funding for the entire care team to manage this complex, chronic, relapsing medical condition. As one of our clients, an older, unhoused woman with longtime opioid use disorder in Eastern Washington, she told one of our community staff, "I've been in and out of treatment throughout my life, and you are the first people to treat me well. So I keep coming back, and I've brought my friends." Opioid use disorder with fentanyl is tough, but we have a third model of care that can help us dramatically close the treatment gap, support recovery, keep people alive, and help restore the health of individuals and their communities.
And that was Dr. Kayla Banta Green testifying before the U.S. Senate Finance Committee in Washington, D.C. And now to Oregon's hunger problem. Eric Tegadoff has more on that.
While Tillamook County, Oregon might be famous for its cheese, many of its residents struggle with food insecurity. The issue is especially acute in the summer when kids are out of school. Levi Johnson is the Tillamook branch operations lead for Oregon Food Bank. He says the breakfasts and lunches some students receive at school can't be the only meals they get all day. His organization is working to fill in those hunger gaps during the summer.
We work with certain programs in our community. We call them summer feeding programs, where they're trying to set up distribution locations to provide free lunch to those students to help fill in that gap and that need to find a meal to get them through the day.
Food insecurity levels in Tillamook County are higher than the state average, at nearly 12%, compared to about 10%, according to the Oregon Hunger Task Force. Food insecurity is even higher for kids in the county, at 19%. The county is home to about 27,000 people. Johnson says the biggest barrier for residents is distance because of Tillamook's rural nature.
We have a lot of areas where to get to the nearest emergency food box site or even a meal site, they could be looking at a 30-minute drive alone, let alone a lot of folks that we serve don't have that kind of transportation, so they're either having to walk or bike.
Johnson notes people can find local food sites at OregonFoodFinder.org, which is available in 19 languages. He says the biggest challenge for food sites in Tillamook County is the need for more volunteers.
A lot of programs we've seen in the past few years close just because they're just not seeing the volunteers coming in to help them. And so we're trying our best to get more people involved.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegadoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 30th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Eric Tegedoff and Alex Gonzalez, the producers Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Full Lomond on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, we invite you to go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, coming up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. Vladimir Putin visits China, American protectionism, Biden's tariffs on Chinese exports, and the U.S. makes an unusual request of China and Russia. First, Putin visits China. Xi Jinping's balancing act with Russia and the West took on a new challenge with Putin's arrival in Beijing. It was roughly the 40th such meeting of these supposedly old friends. Once again, Xi had to demonstrate loyalty to Russia in its war in Ukraine, while also showing sensitivity to European commercial interests and U.S. pressure on China to limit its military support of Putin's war. At least on the surface, Xi came through. He promised to expand all manner of China-Russia ties, fully support their, quote, comprehensive strategic partnership, increase strategic coordination, support Russia's special military operation, not war, in Ukraine, and condemn U.S. dual containment of China and